Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Rogers Smith, who is author of That Is Not Who We Are! Exclamation point, Populism and Peoplehood. This book is published just recently by Yale University Press, and it comes out of some lectures that Rogers gave over the course of, I believe, a year at Yale, but I'll let him explain that. I'd like to welcome Rogers Smith to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project and the shape that it's taken. Hi, Rogers.
Hi, Lily. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me. I am a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, but I did this project as a series of lectures in the fall of 2018 at Yale. They have something called the Castle Lecture Series, where they invite people to present thoughts that eventually get published by the Yale Press. And in the fall of 2018, I was tremendously concerned by the evidence from around the world that we were seeing the rise of a variety of authoritarian leaders and regimes that called themselves populist and sometimes had broad popular support, but that were adopting positions against immigration, against domestic racial, ethnic, and religious minorities, and against a lot of democratic freedoms that I found deeply disturbing. And in all too many respects, Donald Trump's administration was a counterpart to these authoritarian nationalist movements. So I decided I would devote these lectures to considering the character and appeal of these new forms of populism, as they're commonly called, and considering how they might be appropriately countered through political movements that would be more egalitarian and inclusive than these new populisms tended to be.
And in the book, and I assume in the lectures also, but certainly in the book, you go through a variety of different countries. So we're not just talking about, as you note, you are sort of surveying the evidence around the globe as well as in the United States. And so you look at a number of different countries that you've classified in a variety of ways that are seeing some of this, as well as possibly places where there is more hope or more sort of countermeasures. Can you talk a little bit about some of the places where you started to look at these examples? I mean, obviously, we have been looking at places like Viktor Orban's Hungary and a number of other sort of Central and Eastern European countries. But also what you saw in other places as well.
I was very conscious that the rise of authoritarian nationalisms was a global phenomenon. And like most other analysts, I saw that rise as a response to global conditions, the rise of many forms of economic globalization that gave enhanced power to international economic institutions and governing institutions of various sorts that adopted policies that substantial sections of the population within many nations felt were hostile to them. And also in many nations, there are more culturally traditionalist communities that feel deeply threatened both by immigrant groups that are ethnoculturally dissimilar and by the spread of a kind of cosmopolitan perspective adopted by many global elites that they think are dismissive of their traditional values. So there are some common economic and cultural factors contributing to the rise of these authoritarian nationalist movements claiming to speak in the name of the people in many lands. And I chose examples to indicate that this was a wide-ranging phenomena that you can certainly see in Europe, where Viktor Orban in Hungary has been perhaps the most explicit and articulate champion of what he calls illiberal democracy, as well as ethnocultural homogeneity. But this kind of outlook has counterparts in Narendra Modi's call for India first and his privileging of a Hindu conception of national identity. It has a counterpart in Jair Bolsonaro's right-wing nationalism in Brazil. And I go through other examples in the book to make it clear that this is a global phenomenon. And it's important to understand the rise of Donald Trump in light of these broader global patterns as well. Many scholars of American politics, and I don't exclude myself, have often gone wrong by not recognizing the degree to which American developments are part of broader global trends.
And so in this context, and you highlight, you know, sort of these phenomena that are not exclusively Western or European or European and American, but are sort of this question of cultural and economic feelings of assault. And this gets to some of the basis for your analysis in terms of thinking about, as you say in the title of the book, peoplehood. And I know this has long been the center of a lot of the work that you have done that pulls together sort of various sides of political science, an understanding of peoplehood. Can you talk a little bit about that, particularly in this context, and help readers or listeners think about what this term means and how you sort of use it to think about politics?
Yes, I use the term peoplehood as a kind of umbrella term for all kinds of human communities that operate to some extent as political societies. And by being political, I mean that they assert some authority over their members, claim their allegiance in contrast to the claims of other groups. I believe that any time you're saying you're obligated to us and not them, you are being political. And different sorts of human associations do that to much different degrees. The extreme is the kind of political community or association that claims absolute sovereignty, absolute power over their members. But many other kinds of human communities claim authority in over some aspects of people's lives, perhaps their spiritual beliefs, perhaps certain of their economic pursuits, and not other aspects of their lives. So I use peoplehood as this umbrella term for many different kinds of political communities. It's not actually a novel use. If you look through the history of political thought, you will find writers referring to different peoples even before they begin talking so extensively about different nations. But in the modern era, by which I mean particularly the last century and a half, we have come to talk about political communities primarily in terms of nation states that often do claim absolute sovereign power. And I do think that the nation state system is the most important form of political community, of political peoplehood in the world today. But it's far from the only kind. It's not the only form, and it's also one that has, in world historical perspective, relatively recently come to preeminence. Its preeminence is being challenged by many other forms of political association and community in the 21st century. And so I think that it's a mistake to think about political community or political association societies primarily in terms of, or exclusively in terms of nation states. So I think we need a broader term, and I've used peoples and peoplehood as that broader term. It is part of the argument of this book that the very multiplication of many kinds of political community and identity in the 21st century is something that many people experience as challenging, threatening, and that that's heightening the appeal to return, if you will, to nationalism and the nation state as the preeminent form of political community by putting India first, by putting America first, as these recent leaders say. There's some false nostalgia there. Again, the preeminence of the nation state is a relatively recent modern phenomenon, but precisely because it's being challenged on a number of fronts now, many are drawn to reassert it strongly in the current moment.
And in terms of this question of this rise of, as you note, the multiplication of political identities, this is where the book sort of takes off and starts to discuss what we're talking about in terms of not only the identification with a kind of nationalism, which is a connection to a particular country or nation state, but at the sort of in contrast or in conflict or in tension with political identity. But identification with the nation state is another form of political identity. And you sort of talk about these various kinds of political identity that are growing, and that they're also, many of them are constructed in such a way as to be defining for people socially. And they may also be biological, but that these are ways that people think of themselves. And where is the conflict here?
Well, the conflict arises fundamentally from the fact that many people want to have for themselves a secure sense of their core or true or most important political identity, and to make sure that that identity is protected and indeed often made dominant over other rival identities. I have an argument in the book that through much of human history, most people inhabited relatively isolated rural communities. And so even though They, in fact, always possessed multiple identities. They had a trade, they had a religion, they had a role in their families and so forth. These were generally part of fairly unchallenged structure of understanding of their society and their place in their society. In the modern world, not only have our associations and affiliations multiplied in many cases, we're also vividly aware, because we mostly live in cities now, because we're exposed to global technologies now, we're vividly aware of the many alternative identities that some of which we possess, some of which challenge our identities, and this can create a kind of psychological anxiety or dissonance that I think proponents of nationalism appeal to. How do they appeal to it? Well, precisely because every human association is something that is to some degree crafted, created by human beings. Political societies are not simply natural. I've long argued that the process of crafting enduring political communities involves leaders articulating narratives or stories of the political community's identity, stories of peoplehood, as I call them, stories of peoplehood that can only work if they draw on and speak to the pre-existing senses of identity and values and interests that people have, but stories that often, that always try to draw on those elements and craft a sense of the political community's identity that can inspire allegiance to the community and inspire allegiance to these leaders of the community by saying that this community membership will best protect and advance your economic interests. This community membership will protect and advance your personal physical security and give you a share of political power, especially against enemies of your community. And I've argued that these stories of peoplehood also have to have an element that I call a constitutive theme, a theme which says, there's something about what's valuable in who you are that makes community, makes membership in this community something valuable and appropriate for you. And a wide range of human identities can serve as such a constitutive theme. It could be that you share a religion with others in the community. It could be that you share a kind of ethnicity or ancestry. It could be that you share a language or a set of cultural traditions or political traditions. But the argument is that to sustain support over time, because there are always going to be economic bad times and times when your nation isn't doesn't seem so politically powerful, it's very important to have a constitutive theme that says that you belong to this community, you should be loyal to this community because God wants you to be, because being someone who carries on this cultural heritage is essential to who you are, sometimes because your race makes this appropriate. And these kinds of themes making you and your community seem valuable and good, if you believe the story, are very politically potent. Today, we're having leaders tell nationalist stories about the greatness of Indian civilization or how America was great and we can make it great again, that involve these kinds of constitutive themes and can help give people a sense of secure, a secure anchor amidst swirling seas of different identities that they're experiencing today.
And I wanted to ask you a bit about this sort of conception of these narratives and the stories of peoplehood, as you call them, and the way that they sort of do loop citizens in political associations together, and also may, you know, drive them apart from one another. And a lot of what is going on in your discussion in this book is to some degree these competing narratives. Can you talk about kind of the role of narrative in our understanding of sort of political associations and politics? I'm about to start teaching the Republic. And of course, we have those famous myths that Socrates talks about as necessary for the society to hang together. So this is not necessarily something new, but what you're talking about are sort of competing narratives.
Well, I certainly don't think it's at all new. I think that every political community through human history has had narratives of community identity that have sought to make that membership attractive in the ways that I describe. And I do think that Socrates in the Republic gives examples of this when he describes myths that indicate that you have inborn qualities that mean that you are suited to play a certain role in the city, and you'll be fulfilled if you play a certain role in the city. That kind of narrative, and also origin myths, you know, the gods throw seeds on the ground and you grow, you spring up as citizens of a community. These are ubiquitous in one way or another through human history. And I believe that is because while human beings as biological creatures have certain physical needs that do help define what you might want to call their objective or real interests, as some would have it. They are their objective interests if they wish to survive, and most people do. Nonetheless, the ways in which we can meet our biological needs, the ways in which we can meet our psychological needs, vary tremendously. And if people are to decide how they should meet their needs, how they should live, they do so by providing themselves some kind of account of who they are and what their aspirations are or should be, and what kinds of community are appropriate for filling those needs and aspirations. So I think that narratives of different kinds are central features in giving meaning to human experience, but not just giving meaning to human experience, giving particular substance to the way that we'll try and meet our biological and psychological needs. We are social creatures who fulfill our needs within societies, within communities, and that means that the narratives that help sustain particular communities are especially important, the stories of peoplehood. But because people have different aspirations, because people's pursuit of their own physical needs can lead them into conflict, it isn't surprising that rival stories of peoplehood, rival conflicting accounts of what the community should be, arise. Some of these can be sufficiently radical challenges that they suggest purging some people from the community or seceding from the community and forming a different one. Some of these accounts can suggest that the needs and aspirations of the community can best be met by conquering other peoples and communities. So stories of peoplehood are both bound up with building societies through which people can fulfill their needs and aspirations. They define the ways to fulfill those needs and aspirations, but they are also always stories that can bring some groups of people into conflict with other groups of people within and beyond the boundaries of their current communities.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And you go through some different communities in particular that you're also situating in terms of sort of a timeline construction about how they are designing some of these understandings of peoplehood. And you talk about post-communist countries, post-imperial countries, and dissident communities. Can you talk a little bit about the particular countries that you're looking at and how they sort of are examples of some of these tensions around populism and these narratives of peoplehood?
Yes, I sought to identify examples in which you could see conflicts between the kinds of more authoritarian populist movements invoking traditionalist senses of political identity that I was concerned with, and other views of political identity or peoplehood. I was looking for places where there were these kinds of conflicts, but again, there's lots and lots of those examples in the world today. They weren't hard to find.
Of course.
So then the question was, well, I need a small set of examples, and I decided to choose ones that represented three great waves of the building of nation states, and therefore ultimately the modern nation state system. And the first nation states emerged in Europe with countries like Great Britain and France. I chose Northern Ireland as a product of the first wave of nation building. That first wave of nation building involved nation states that created empires. Northern Ireland is, after all, an imperial possession. And so I also wanted an example from the first imperial colony to break away and become a new nation, and that was the United States. So I also use the United States as an example. So beyond that first wave of nation state building and imperial nation state building, which began really in a big way in the 18th century and created a world structured by nation states with empires that prevailed up into World War II, then after World War II, we had the ending of the European empires and the Japanese empire, and we had a wave of new nation states being built. So I chose an example from that period of, or a couple of examples from that period of new nation building, including India, the former British colony, and the United Arab Emirates, who were never a former British colony, but were essentially a collection of tribes effectively subjected to British rule prior to becoming an independent nation. And then the Soviet Union represented a great modern empire that actually expanded after World War II, but came to an end in 1989. And so I looked at the Czech Republic and the Slovak nation as examples of the nations that emerged after the fall of the Soviet Union. So I chose examples from those three waves of nation state building, but I also looked for the conflicts within them between more traditionalist forms of political community that were hostile to many of the changes going on in the world, different forms of globalization, and so forth, and also the forces within those political communities that sought to resist the harsher exclusionary and repressive impulses that many champions of more traditionalist forms of peoplehood were advocating.
And you also, in having these or presenting these examples, you are sort of talking about this these tensions, as we've noted, between the people who are potentially more connected to a nostalgic understanding of national peoplehood, and those pushing against some of that. Can you talk about what you saw in one or two of these examples?
Well, first, I want to emphasize, consistent with what I was stressing earlier, that the appeal to an older sense of peoplehood is not necessarily always nationalistic. I discuss using Kathy Kramer's excellent book, The Politics of Resentment, how within the state of Wisconsin, there's an older rural population that sees themselves with some justice as threatened both economically and culturally by broader changes in the world that include the rise of political and intellectual and economic elites within Wisconsin that they see as not understanding their rural ways of life, not appreciative of the virtues of that way of life, and as adopting policies that are threatening that rural way of life, policies they resent, hence the politics of resentment. And these people became supporters of Scott Walker for governor prior to becoming supporters, in many cases, of Donald Trump for president, because they saw these people as, these candidates, as opponents of the snobbish, self-serving elites at the University of Wisconsin and in the capital at Madison, Wisconsin, who were adopting a variety of state policies governing education and resource development, taxation, and so forth, that really serve the interests of these urban populations much more than rural populations. And they also saw these urban elites as looking down on them. That led them to be drawn to someone who championed them as the true and best people of Wisconsin. Certainly Trump would count them as amongst the true and best people he's championing in the United States. That's an example of an appeal to a traditionalist sense of peoplehood that is compatible with a certain sense of American national identity and favors certain senses of American national identity over others. But it is also, and most immediately, a kind of sense of rural Wisconsin peoplehood that is felt to be under attack and in need of defense at both the state and national levels. Now, the rural Wisconsin folks feel themselves an aggrieved minority population. In India, Modi and his party, the BJP, are championing the interests of the supermajority Hindu population, or so they claim. But that's in part because they believe that the support for the traditional non-Hindu groups and lower caste groups that make up a substantial part of the population of India, particularly the Muslims, but others as well, that those groups helped write protections for themselves into the India Constitution as amended, and that these policies have, along with forces of economic globalization, have combined to mean that India isn't achieving the unity and the national economic policies that it needs to realize its full greatness in rivalry with China, the United States, and the rest of the world. And so Modi has been championing a Hindu nationalism that he says will restore the ancient greatness of India. It is associated with policies of fierce repression toward Muslims and other minority groups in India. There are people who can appeal to the traditions of the different, but still more inclusive traditions of Gandhi with his view of India as an inclusive democratic nation, or the Dalit intellectual B.R. Ambedkar and his view of India as one that as a nation that has a special obligation to assist the long discriminated against lower caste groups. There are other traditions that can be used to combat this Hindu nationalism in India, but it's a conflict that is all the more challenging there because Modi, his populism, his Hindu religious nationalistic populism actually is appealing to the majority of the people in his nation. Doesn't guarantee him success, but it does mean that his movement is even more powerful than that of the rural Wisconsin folks in his national context.
And you also bring up Denmark and Israel. which don't usually get classified together very often, as part of a different sort of context or another example of sort of more inclusive stories. Can you talk about how Israel, which is often seen as someplace full of conflict, and Denmark, not so much, as part of this different connection?
Well, I do see certain commonalities, despite obviously there being very great differences. You correctly describe Denmark as a country that is not marked by severe internal conflicts today, but it was through the first part of the 20th century, late 19th and 20th century, when it had a number of lines of division, none more important than the clashes between farm and labor movements about what kinds of economic policies and governing institutions Denmark was to have as it moved from an actual monarchy to a more formal constitutional monarchy. After World War II, the Danes reduced their conflict substantially by an agreement between farm and labor parties to support the modern Danish social welfare state, to agree on economic political institutions through which the Danes would pay a very high percentage of their income into taxes in exchange for a very broad array of state services, health, housing, education, and more going all through their lives. The Danish social welfare state is this peace pact, and it is held together by the cultural symbols of Danish peoplehood, their devotion to the flag, to the Danish National Church, and other elements of Danish political culture. They see this unity as threatened by immigrants who come in and are culturally distinct and who also they fear will try and seek the benefits of the Danish social welfare state without having paid into it through their taxes throughout their lives the way the Danes have. And so the Danish People's Party, which is not particularly right-wing on economic policies, it supports the Danish social welfare state, which is not particularly authoritarian, at least so far. It is strongly anti-immigrant, and it does champion preserving Danish cultural homogeneity as a means of preserving the Danish social welfare state that ended very severe conflicts. Israel's situation is one where, of course, there are profound conflicts between the Israelis who want Israel to be a Jewish state and the more than 20% of the population that is not Jewish, that are mostly Arabs of one variety or another. And it's a familiar point that the tension between the tension in Israel's founding documents, which proclaim it to be both a Jewish and democratic state, are definitive, constitutive, if you will, of Israeli national identity. Can you be a Jewish state and still be a democratic state when more than a fifth of your population are not Jews? They have struggled with that throughout their existence. And in the recent couple of decades, including in recent years, they've moved more and more strongly to asserting Jewish national identity, adopting policies that make it more difficult for Arabs from outside Israel to marry Jewish Arabs and to marry Israeli Arabs and to come into Israel, increasing the size of the non-Jewish minority in Israel, and of course also seeking to acquire lands that at the expense of Arab settlers that expand Jewish settlement. These efforts within Israel are combated by many Jews inside and outside Israel who do want Israel to be in some sense a Jewish state, but also want it to be a genuinely democratic state with full and equal rights for its non-Jewish citizens. But part of the population sees that as threatening to Israel's unity and survival in just the same way that the Danish People's Party see immigrants as threatening Denmark's unity and ultimate survival. Yes, the cases are in important respects different, but you can see the same kinds of conflicts over building and sustaining a sense of peoplehood in both places.
I wanted to ask you, in context of some of these examples that you've just outlined, and as you sort of note throughout the book, these conflicting or tense narratives, that you ask at the end of the book, why should people follow those who call them to join in a difficult journey, which may be a narrative or a sort of concept of peoplehood that is harder or not as potentially immediately satisfying, rather than leaders who promise to restore to them a glorious past? Why should people accommodate those they despise or those they see as threats to what they most value? Can you tell us a little bit about how you start to answer that question?
Yes, I think that it's true, really, within the traditions that have shaped every modern society. And it's also true in the awareness of traditions that everyone possesses today, which includes some knowledge of traditions that are not primarily from within our communities, but that we learn about through the enhanced knowledge we have of the whole world. Everyone has been shaped by moral traditions, which indicate that all human beings have value and worth that deserves to be respected. Everyone, therefore, is partly influenced by, constituted by, moral traditions that support more egalitarian and inclusive policies. Plus, we live in a world today where we are very aware that we all face problems that transcend national borders and probably can be met only through the cooperative action of human beings, not just within but beyond their existing communities. The challenges of climate change are not ones that any one nation can resolve by itself. The challenges of the global economy are ones that inevitably require cooperative agreements amongst different countries if they can be confident of prospering going forward. Challenges of immigration and human movements and refugees, these are things that you can try to resolve simply by building walls and closing ports of entry. The reality is that we're likely to continue to experience those immigrant and refugee pressures unless we have some kinds of transnational cooperative arrangements that deal with them more constructively. So both at the level of our senses of at least some of our deepest moral commitments and our awareness of claims as to what our moral commitments should be that we hear from many voices, and at the level of our material interests in life and physical security and prosperity, we have lots of reasons for saying that we actually should try to build communities that are more inclusive and egalitarian internally, and that work harmoniously in cooperation with other political societies instead of in isolation or sharp opposition. There are things to build on for those kinds of policies in every society, just as there are also powerful senses of interest and identity and value that push against them in every society. I happen to believe that politics is really important, that politics really matters, that the outcomes of the conflicts that arise from these conflicting senses of interest, identity, and value, the outcomes are not inevitable. And we are engaged in very intense struggles right now as to what kinds of policies, what kinds of senses of who we are will prevail in many lands, and the fate of the world literally hangs in the balance. To some degree, that's always true. I think today it is more acutely true than at many times in the past, and it is acutely true in the United States in 2020.
So on that happy note, Roger, what are you working on now to follow this up?
I'm working on a couple of different projects with Desmond King of Oxford for a number of years. I've written works on American racial politics, and we're arguing that American racial politics is entering a new and in some ways more polarized and divided phase right now, in ways that are tied to this rise of more authoritarian nationalist forms of populism, more traditionalist conceptions of political identity. We have a sharp divide in this country between those who feel that efforts to assist minorities and welcome immigrants have gone so far that the traditional white population in this country and their ways of life are endangered and need to be protected against further egalitarian and inclusive changes. And we have a substantial portion of the population that has been energized by the repeated evidence of police brutality against especially young Black men and people of color more generally, to believe that the country must do much more, and many countries must do much more to end systemic racism in many forms and try to achieve genuine inclusion for long discriminated against and still discriminated against minority populations. This clash between what we call the white protectionists and the racial reparationists is, I think, even more intense than the nation's racial divisions in recent years. And it has the potential to go either way in ways that could significantly transform America as a nation. So I'm paying a lot of attention to that. I have a longer-term project building on my earlier work where I closely studied the development of American citizenship from the founding era through the progressive era, and I am at work on the a study of the evolution of American citizenship from the progressive era to the present day, and it's a work that I call Civic Horizons, because amongst those developments is this mounting questioning of whether the nation state is the appropriate horizon for political community, or whether we should seek to move beyond it in the 21st century. I don't think it's plausible to seek to move beyond the nation state as the basic locus of citizenship right now. I think the challenge is still to try to make the forms of civic life we have within our nations better, more inclusive, egalitarian, and more fulfilling for more people than in the past. But again, I think we're coming to the realization that we can only do so if we pursue forms of political peoplehood that are not just open, but eager to engage cooperatively with other political peoples, with other nations, in working together to confront the larger challenges that the world presents to us all.
Well, I hope you will come on the New Books podcast again and talk to me about one or two of those projects when they're out and published.
Well, I look forward to being in a position to do so. A lot of work to be done, but I would love to do it.
I understand. Thank you so much for joining me today, Roger Smith, who is author of That Is Not Who We Are, Populism and Peoplehood, published in 2020 by Yale University Press, and I assume available at the Yale University Press website.
Absolutely. And thank you very much, Lily.
It's my pleasure.